And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Days of contentious public meetings over how the city of Cincinnati will spend its money in the new fiscal year resulted in council ultimately rejecting calls to defund the police. And the zombie streetcar lives on, too. Joining us now to talk about this week at City Hall, Cincinnati Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wederick. He's on the phone with us. Chris, hello.
Hey, how are you?
I'm well. Thanks for being with us. Also on the phone is Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Sharon Coolidge. Sherry, thank you for being with us also.
Thanks for having me.
And on the studio line is WVXU reporter Jay Hanselman. Hi, Jay.
Happy to be here.
It's been a long time since we've had all three of you together, so this should be a robust conversation. We'll try not to get too chaotic, but chaos certainly erupted for parts of the meeting this week in City Hall. Let's listen to a little bit of what happened.
Mr. Chair, are you going to do something?
I'm not okay with this. People are trying to speak. This is not okay.
I am also not okay with this. Mr. Chair, you cannot have people who are waiting to speak arrested. I do not stand by that. You gave the order. Please correct it.
This is
Mr.
Not okay.
Chair, you gave the order. Please do something.
I'm trying to let the police do their job, and I was
asked them to do this.
I asked them to make sure that people were escorted who already spoke.
Mr. Chair, there are people being made to leave these chambers.
No one should be made to leave.
Who did not speak.
Mr. Chair, you gave the order.
Why don't you let the police do their job for a minute and stop trying
They're doing what you asked them to do.
Okay, again, that was Cincinnati City Hall this week during a council meeting where the budget was to be voted on. And it erupted into chaos. You heard some expletives deleted from that. Those words were delivered by some of the people who were being removed from the chambers, not the members of council themselves. Sharon, tell us a little bit about what was happening at that moment.
You know, it was a contentious meeting. We heard from the same voices that we had been hearing from the whole previous week. You know, really talking this group of people, defund the police. In very angry ways. You know, there was a lot of expletives used, and they're just, you know, a lot of derogatory terms, not your typical budget hearing. But they were a very passionate crowd, and it really spilled over, you know, into the public speaking part of City Council. And I was outside in the hall when it first broke out. They were ushering people in and out for social distancing purposes, so there wasn't a lot of people in the room at the same time. But everybody wanted to speak, and it was kind of happening during this exchange of here's this first group and a second group. And, you know, people were not orderly, which is what's typical. I mean, there's a whole process. Sign a speaker's card, wait your turn, talk for 2 minutes. And a lot of decorum, like, comes into that, and that was not happening. And the mayor, you know, he's running public speaking, and he wanted to restore order. And then, well, all heck broke loose.
Well, Jay, you were there.
And Michael, I was going to say I can add to that. Essentially, Sherry's right. They had changed. They were bringing people in 20 at a time, and the second group of 20, I believe, had finished. Some of the people in that group said that they were not recognized to speak. And while all this was going on, there was a person who was speaking via Zoom, and she was trying to deliver her remarks, and these people were saying, you know, we weren't called to speak, and it turned into a shouting match, and the mayor asked the police department to restore order, and like Sherry said, it was downhill from there.
And the reference to Mr. Chair, that was a reference to Mayor John Cranley. That was mostly P.G. Sittenfeld, the councilman that we heard that, it sounded like, and we also heard Chris Silbach early on in that, and also Councilman Wendell Young. So let me turn it over to Chris Wederick from the Business Courier. A lot of the people who had been speaking in recent days about the budget were calling for defund the police. And as we typically say when we bring that up, that means different things to different people. But ultimately, it looks like most of the Cincinnati Police Department budget is similar to as it always is it not?
Yeah, correct, Michael. I mean, they really held it flat. There was an increase that the city manager and the mayor had proposed for the police department. Council instead diverted about $1 million of that. So the increase was about $1 million, and they took $1 million and instead put it into the Cincinnati Recreation Department budget, and that will be used for some kind of summer job employment for youth and younger people. That's more than that initiative, I think, typically gets. So I think that that was their attempt to try to send a signal to people that they had heard what they were saying and understand. But as far as any kind of wholesale changes to the police department in terms of its budget or structure, that is not going to be the case after the budget was passed.
And again, we're joined by Cincinnati Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich, Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Sherry Coolidge, and WVXU reporter Jay Hanselman. Sherry, one of the complaints that we had heard from some people was whether there would be full funding for what is known as the Citizens Complaint Authority. This is something that provides oversight for the police department, reviews some complaints against the police department. What ultimately happened with that?
You know, the budget really does what the speakers were asking. And I have to say, as much as there was so much contention and all this chaos, their voices were heard. And I think this budget was set to go through with not as many social services and police oversight as we find that we did see in the end. So these voices were heard, which we knew already going in to budget approval, you know, council. But it does provide, the CCA is fully funded, that's the Citizens Oversight Police Board. It finally is going to have enough people. It's been underfunded for years, making like a backlog of cases. They're really going to have the resources to do the work that they are supposed to do. Just having it isn't enough. There's another $240,000 going to all kind of like data analytics to help the police better. Look at the traffic stops, look at disparities. And there's also, Jeff Pastor brought forward a whole idea about, you know, starting at the 911 center. This is being, you know, tested in other cities where there's some mental health response, because not every call is, I need a police officer. It's just 911, and sometimes it's mental health. And so we're going to tiptoe and do some baby steps into a program that really starts to get at that. So there is a lot of what they were asking for in the whole idea of defunding the police. It's like doing the more.
Jay, you're always good at explaining process about city government. So we got explainers from you on how this budget process works. Well, now the fiscal year is set to begin with a budget in place. What does the council start to discuss next? And we'll talk about this before we get into the streetcar section of the budget.
I was going to say the streetcar is next.
Okay.
But no, I mean, I think P.G. Sittenfeld, I thought, had a good quote. After this was all over, the speakers may not have got what they wanted this time. And I think part of that was because of the compressed nature of this budget. Typically, the city manager releases a budget in the first part of May, and council essentially has about 2 months to look at it. They got this budget on June the 11th and had to have it passed by June the 24th. So it was a pretty compressed timeline. And Sherry's right. They ended up making about $4 million worth of changes to the general fund budget. But I think the speakers and their defunding arguments have planted some seeds for the next budget, particularly with, I mean, a lot of these things, if you're going to, you know, take money away from the police department, a lot of that is going to involve the union contract with the Fraternal Order of Police. That contract expires next May. So I think there'll be some focus on, you know, do we make changes to that contract? What changes can we make to that contract? Can there be savings? And, you know, while there was a start on some funding for human services and social services, you know, that could be amplified and expanded on in the budget that will come around a year from now.
And Chris, I imagine that we'll start to see some of the political optics play out a little bit more since this fiscal year does go into the next year, which is when the mayoral election campaigning will start. And we saw a little bit of that as part of the ruckus that took place. We played a little bit from that, but that extended version of that sound does include some back and forth over you can do what you want to do when you're mayor, basically. So talk a little bit about how the politics of that election coming up could play into the way council members are getting along and working together.
Well, you know, there's two members of council running for mayor as we speak. That would be P.G. Sittenfeld and David Mann. Who knows whether others will get in? I've kind of wondered whether Vice Mayor Christopher Smitherman is seriously rethinking what he's doing. You know, I think there could be more, whether it's the vice mayor or somebody else. You didn't see the dynamics of, I didn't really see Sittenfeld and Mann try to one-up each other during this process. I thought they generally work together to the extent possible. But there was this issue last week where Councilman Mann ended the budget hearing prior to, you know, people really being done speaking, because there was a similar kind of ruckus at that point. And so some people think that's going to play a role in the mayor's race. To me, it just depends on the people that we're seeing showing up at these meetings. Are they going to vote in basically a year from now in the 2021 November mayoral election? I think there's a real question about that. You know, in city elections, the electorate tends to be older. It tends to be more conservative. It tends to be people who have voted repeatedly and not first-time voters. So this could either really shake things up, or maybe it could, kind of die off in terms of the movement. We will see locally. And I think there's also questions about the composition of these folks. Were they city residents? Were they from out of the region? You know, I think that's a really interesting question that we're not going to know the answer to until about a year from, maybe a year and a half from now.
The term zombie streetcar has been referenced multiple times, and it looks like that situation will continue. We've got some sound from the city council meeting as it relates to the streetcar, too. You'll hear Jan Michelle Lemon Kearney talking to, I believe, Mayor John Cranley in this soundbite.
I just want to say, you know, we're giving a lot of airtime to the streetcar. You vetoed it. It's over. We've got the zombie, as Councilmember Smitherman calls, choo-choo train. Okay, let's take all this energy and put it into fighting systemic racism. Let's get out here, talk about police reform. Let's put all this energy where it needs to go now. The streetcar is over. Let's move on.
But that's not where city council is putting its money, our money, the people's money. The fact is, I heard Mr. Avner say this, I heard Mr. Seelbach say this yesterday, I wish we weren't talking about the streetcar. Well, then stop paying for it and start paying for the things that we've heard on the street of social services and social justice. I love it how people say, I'm going to pay for what my pet project is, and then eventually I'll get to the things that we supposedly really care about.
Jay, what happened with the streetcar?
There were two competing proposals put before the Budget and Finance Committee this week, and basically it comes down to a difference of $2 million. The city could spend $3 million and the streetcar would not operate during the fiscal year, or you could spend roughly $5 million and it would operate. And council approved the plan to spend the $5 million and to have it operate. The one change would be there would be no fares, so now you could ride the streetcar for free. Council approved that 7-2, and immediately, the fastest veto that I've ever seen, as soon as they said that it passed, Mayor Cranley announced, I'm going to veto this, and then went into an extended explanation of why he was vetoing it.
And we are talking with Jay Hanselman from WVXU. We're also joined by Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wetterick and Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Sherry Coolidge. And we have some callers on the line. Let's take some calls now. We've got Billy first. Hi, Billy. What's your question or comment?
Hi. I just had a comment to remark on the way that speakers were being called into the meeting as sort of a matter of procedure.
Okay, please go ahead.
The way the people were being called in and called up to speak was from a stack of cards that people had signed up on, which was shown pretty early on in the meeting to not be accurate to the people being called into the chambers, 20 people at a time. Later in the meeting, they moved to escorting people in one by one to eliminate that confusion. But the sort of chaotic moment breaking out where 20 people were all dismissed at once happened because Mayor Cranley wasn't acknowledging the fact that his stack of cards didn't reliably call upon everyone present in the room at the moment. And so when he waved in the security detail to escort everyone out en masse, it wasn't explained to anyone present that if you hadn't been called, because the cards were inaccurate, you would be permitted to come back in a later group of people. So the chaos was because people thought that they were missing their one opportunity to address the room because their card hadn't been called yet, and it might not be called.
All right, Billy, we appreciate the call and appreciate your perspective. Thanks for calling in and listening. And we also have on the line another Sherry. Hi, Sherry. What's your question or comment?
Hi, my name is Sherry Swarderup. I was sitting in the room when all this happened. I didn't start recording on my phone until after the original person had been arrested. So I was just so shocked. I didn't have the wherewithal to start recording yet. But I think the timing is very important here. Yes, there was definitely disturbance going on, but the order of events that has been stated so far seems to be a little bit off, and I think it's very important to understand what the correct order is. So we...
well, we'll have to go very quickly. I apologize, Sherry, but we will have to go quickly through this comment.
Okay. So they announced the Zoom calls were going to happen and that anyone who's spoken, please leave. So many of us remained in our seats because we had not spoken yet. And Mayor Cranley waved in the police and they started picking this man up out of his chair. And that is when everyone jumped up and started shouting because the man had done nothing. He's sitting there silently, being very polite. And even when they picked him up out of his chair, he did not fight or yell. And everybody was very upset because there was no reason for him to be arrested. His arms were put behind his back and dragging him out as if he were a criminal. And he was just waiting his turn to speak.
Sherry,
and I think that's important.
Thank you so much for the call and sharing your perspective with us. We appreciate it. We've got one more to get to. We have Erica. Hi, Erica. Your question or comment, please.
Hi. I wanted to first say that I'm 32 years old. I'm a city resident. I'm not a first-time voter. And a lot of those people that have been speaking, I know they are city residents. Stream of the council session. And what I found most outrageous was particularly Mayor Cranley's body language and facial expressions. It was very clear he wasn't listening to people. There were several people that asked him to pay attention. There was a 14-year-old girl, I believe, who asked him to get off of his phone. So you can't expect people to maintain decorum when you're basically rolling your eyes at people. I mean, he might not have exactly done that, but the behavior was outrageous from a leadership standpoint.
Erica, thank you so much for the call and the perspective. We appreciate it very much. Again, we're with Sherry Coolidge from the Cincinnati Inquirer, Chris Swederick from the Business Courier, and Jay Hanselman from right here at WVXU. In our final moments together, I'll give each of you a chance to either respond to what you heard from the callers who called in, or if there's something that we left out in our conversation or something that you think that we should be looking for as we move forward with council and government business. Sherry, we'll start with you.
I mean, I don't think this is the last we've heard from people who really are going to be coming into council, public speaking, to have their say and tell council where they're coming from. These are generally, you know, younger citizens. During the budget process, we hear from social service agencies. It's the same groups of people all the time. These are new voices at the city hall, and I think because the budget is done, it's not done. I think that we're going to keep seeing some of these speakers come in.
Okay, and let's go to Chris now.
Just on the streetcar, I thought that it was a completely unnecessary fight. You know, we should acknowledge there were some tough decisions made about the budget, but nothing draconian happened, which is kind of amazing considering the deficit they faced, which was basically one out of every $5 the city spends. I mean, council basically and the mayor swiped the taxpayer's credit card and borrowed $10 million to make this work. It would be one thing to say, you know, oh, we should cancel the streetcar if they had to lay off any city employees, but they didn't. I think that we've all seen over the years in the budget that the city has found money for anything that the elected officials wanted to do. And they probably could have done that in this case, even negotiated a lesser service streetcar. So this drama that is going on right now is completely unnecessary.
And Jay, the final word falls on you.
I'll just pick up on the streetcar. Clearly, there are the votes to override the mayor's veto if it gets to that in August. It has to wait till August because it can't happen until the next regularly scheduled meeting. Just one thing that I was hoping we'd have more time to talk about, but we're not going to get to.
No, please go right ahead. We got a couple.
No, there's a narrative going around on social media that perhaps because council is taking $1.5 million from the transit fund to run the streetcar, that somehow is money that's coming out of Issue 7 that was approved by county voters, a sales tax to fund Metro starting in October. That tax hasn't even started collection yet. SORTA won't get a payment until January. None of the Issue 7 money is going to run the streetcar. And a matter of fact, for that to happen, SORTA would have to write the city a check, and that's not going to happen.
That's Jay Hanselman from WVXU, Chris Wederick from the Business Courier, and Sherry Coolidge from the Cincinnati Inquirer. It's been a while since we had all of you together. It's always great perspective and analysis. I look forward to the days when we can all sit in the studio together again. Thanks for your reporting and sharing it with us.
Thank you.
Up next, we're going to go to Kentucky, where the Democratic primary for U.S. Senate is over in terms of the campaigning, but the vote counting is ongoing. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Voters and Senator Mitch McConnell wait to see who the Democratic Party nominated for November's headline election. Charles Booker and Amy McGrath are finished with the primary campaigning, but the votes are still being counted. So joining us now is Courier Journal reporter Joe Sonka. Joe, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And I think this is the first time you've been on the show since you and your team at the CJ won the Pulitzer Prize for your outstanding reporting on ex-Governor Matt Bevin's pardons. So congratulations.
Thank you very much, Michael. Appreciate it.
And I think we're also joined on the line now by Daniel DeRochers, the reporter from the Lexington Herald-Leader. Daniel, welcome to you as well.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And congratulations on your outstanding room rating from that Twitter feed that rates people's Zoom screens. I think that that's a pretty high achievement as well, so that was pretty cool.
Yeah, I don't think it's as good as a Pulitzer, but I'll take it. I made that bookshelf from scratch.
Your day is coming, I'm sure. Joe, let's start with you. My goodness, I think you and Daniel and a lot of Kentucky media and politicos and just general citizens were responding to a lot of national pundit, I guess, questioning of the way voting was taking place in Kentucky, as if there was a lot of suppression taking place. Can you just, before we dive into what's happening right now, give us a little bit of the landscape of what voting looked like on Tuesday and in the days leading up to it and what some national outlets may have gotten wrong?
Well, it was completely unrecognizable to what it usually is. When it comes to the voting access, we have one of the most restrictive, some of the most restrictive laws in the country. You can only vote on Tuesday, election day, from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., and you cannot vote by mail or do early voting unless you have an excuse. So usually it's like 98%, 99% of people voting in person on election day. But because of the pandemic, you had Democratic Governor Andy Beshear and a Republican Secretary of State, Michael Adams, and the bipartisan Board of Elections, they really came together. And in April, when we were still in the heat of the pandemic, and decided that we're going to completely scrap this and change it and try to make it as much vote by mail as possible. So you no longer need an excuse to get an absentee ballot in the mail. You no longer need an excuse to vote in early in person. And so what we've done is actually broken a record for a primary in terms of the numbers of people who voted. We're about to pass 1 million votes in the primary. The previous record was 2008, when we had about 922,000 people. And that number is going to keep rising because the overwhelming majority, probably close to 80% of people who voted this year, did so by mail. And that's just, we've never seen anything like that.
And so, Daniel, what we were seeing from commentators and even high profile figures like Hillary Clinton go from calling this voter suppression in Kentucky, because basically most counties were down to one polling place for physical in-person voting on the day of election. And then we saw Hillary Clinton shift to congratulating the governor on the way that the election was handled. What was missed by folks who were watching this election from outside our borders?
So people were really focused on the fact that there were just one polling place. They weren't taking into consideration all of the different accommodations that were made beforehand, especially this push for vote by mail, where they even made the process easier by creating this online portal. But I think it's also important to note that a lot of this came after Representative Charles Booker's campaign sent out an email on Saturday morning that said, you know, this is intentional voter suppression. And, you know, that's kind of a big deal. I mean, he's a sitting state rep accusing a governor of his own party of intentionally suppressing the vote. And so that sort of email, we saw a lot of that language kind of catch hold in the social media kind of campaign that was going on about raising awareness about Kentucky's voter suppression. And it was so prevalent. It was so widespread. You know, I had friends that I went to college with in Arizona putting it on their Instagram stories that Kentucky was suppressing the vote. You know, they had me on to MSNBC to talk about how there were concerns about the election, and I had to go on and be like, hey, no, pay attention to the local reporters. Like, there's actually been a deal that's struck. This is probably a more inclusive voting process than we've ever had in Kentucky. And so, you know, it was this kind of, you know, it was almost like a class on misinformation and how misinformation spreads so quickly and how it's so hard to combat once it's out there. I mean, it was really tough.
And it's interesting to note that some of this may have originated with one of the candidates who are now waiting with bated breath on the results. Joe, we did see you out of Jefferson County with the one polling place there that there was a situation where people who were showing up to vote in person at the fairgrounds, they did get locked out at one point, and then some drama unfolded and the doors were reopened. We saw some video from you and others where people were banging on the doors demanding to be brought in to vote. What did you see that at that moment?
Yeah, it was a really calm, efficient process the entire day until around 6 o'clock when voting is supposed to end in Kentucky by law. So most of the day you had literally no lines at all. People would walk in and go straight to the booth and get their ballot and then, or to the table, get their ballot and then go vote because it was such a huge place and so many had already voted by mail that were going to vote. But the issue came at 6 o'clock this is again, one polling location and it's a huge facility at the fairgrounds that has a huge parking lot. And so there were people trying to get there at 6 PM. And if you are in line by 6 p.m., by law, you're allowed to vote. But the question is, what is the line? Is the line that you've come into the Kentucky Exposition Center, or is the line that you've entered the fairgrounds, and even though you might be in your car? So the Jefferson County Clerk's office initially said, you have to be inside this building, or you're not allowed in. So before 6 o'clock, there were poll workers waving people in, telling them to run, and people were literally sprinting in from the parking lot with their kids, and they finally closed the door at 6:03 after letting some in for a few minutes. And then you had 50 people waiting outside, locked out, who were starting to bang on the door. At that point, Charles Booker's campaign requested an injunction from a judge, and the judge granted that, and those people came in and actually were allowed to vote. So in the end, those people did vote, but it was some pretty high drama there for about 15 minutes.
And we're talking with Joe Sonka from the Courier-Journal and Daniel DeRochers from the Herald Leader about the election results in Kentucky and the election process as well. Daniel, in terms of misinformation, as results started to be announced, we saw some misinformation again because it looked like the early results that were released publicly were from the in-person voting only. And as Joe noted, a ton of the votes that are coming from this record turnout in a primary are mailed in, and we don't know the results of those yet, but yet we saw national websites, national news outlets talk about a percentage of precincts reporting that looked pretty significant with one candidate over the other. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's driving me crazy. We know nothing. And, you know, like, there's even, like, some of the national websites are saying, like, it's too close to call. It's not too close to call. It's too early to call. So we're seeing just such a small fraction of the votes that have come in because most places are just reporting their in-person votes. So if you think about Lexington, so about 3,760 people went through Commonwealth Stadium on Election Day in Lexington. And only 2,000 people were voted in the Democratic primary. That's just such a small fraction of what the overall votes are going to be. Lexington got 12,000 ballots in the mail on Election Day alone. And so reading into any of these numbers, yeah, you can glean a little bit about how it appears that, you know, Charles Booker did have that surge, right? He turned out his people on Election Day. But it's such a small fraction that in terms of the election at large, it's really, really difficult to draw any kind of conclusion from it. You know, we genuinely just don't know who's going to win, and we just kind of have to wait it out and see what happens when we actually get more vote totals on the 30th.
Joe, how will that work on the 30th? Is it just going to be one big announcement, or are we going to have slow reports and all the excitement when watching broadcasts and websites, or is it just a big one drop?
According to the Secretary of State, after 6 o'clock, sometime after 6 o'clock, they are going to release all of the Eastern time zone county results. And then an hour later, central time zone part of the state, which is much smaller, is going to release all of their county totals. That is the plan. we don't know if that's going to change or not. Originally, Jefferson County said they weren't going to release any vote totals whatsoever until June 30th. They did eventually release and confirm their in-person voting results from Tuesday. But as of right now, it looks like I haven't seen any other counties release new numbers in the past 24 hours. So it seems like we are going to wait until June 30th, and then we'll get it all at once.
Okay, so Daniel, where does the race stand now? I'm not going to ask you to tell me how many precincts are reporting or who's leading whom, but based on what we do know, what can you glean from the in-person results?
The Charles Booker had a turnout operation that was going, especially in Lexington and Louisville. When you look at the margins that he got in person on Election Day in Lexington and Louisville, they're really, really high. But this is also kind of what we were anticipating going into this, right? Amy McGrath was going to lead in kind of the early absentee votes before Booker surged. It'll be another question to see where McGrath is in terms of the absentee ballot that came in closer to Election Day. I think that part of what we saw is, you know, where we see cities where Booker did pretty well, we see Kenton County, we see Lexington, we see Louisville, we see Warren County. We see a lot of areas where there are college students, you know, and I think that there's certainly something to be said about how Charles Booker motivated and fired up younger voters. Again, like the big thing is like, is this enough, right? Charles Booker is trying to make up a lot of ground on Amy McGrath. She spent more than $21 million on this election. Now, most of that was geared toward going after Mitch McConnell, but she spent a lot of money on this election and she had a lot of name recognition. So it depends on, there are just so many factors going into this. There are so many moving pieces that it's really difficult to kind of glean anything, right? I've talked to, it appears that both campaigns feel pretty comfortable with where things are right now. And that's kind of telling that we really don't know where things are going.
And so, Joe, this is also maybe a criticism of mail-in voting, right? Because you get to do it so far out from the actual election date that if you are a candidate who starts to gain momentum in the waning days of a campaign and a voter sees you for the first time in this new light or this different perspective and your ballot's already cast, then it really doesn't help that candidate.
Right. And I'll use my mother as an example, who lives in Lexington as a registered Democrat. She got her absentee ballot as soon as she could and turned it back in the next day and voted for McGrath. And then a few weeks ago, she regretted that decision. It was like, oh, I wish I had voted for Booker now. And you really wonder, and that's another part of the mystery here in trying to read the tea leaves of who's ahead, who's not ahead, is that it might depend on how many turned in that absentee ballot really early, how many waited until the last week to turn that in. So if you look at the in-person, some of the in-person totals, it might be good for pretty Booker, like he had that surge at the end, but if a lot of those people turned in their absentee ballots early before he had that surge starting in late May, early June, then it might have been too late.
Joe, we heard from...
Joe, I can't...
Oh, please, go ahead, Daniel.
I was just going to say, Joe, I can't believe you're not protecting the sanctity of the ballot box. Well, Grimes isn't running in this race, so we can do
this. So, Joe, we also heard from the third major candidate who was running in this Democratic primary, Mike Breuer. He had the support of Andrew Yang and that Yang gang that grew in popularity on Twitter when Andrew Yang, the businessman, was running in the Democratic presidential primary. So he had some success in fundraising to some degree as well, but it did appear as Election Day was nearing that McGrath and Booker were distancing themselves from him in terms of enthusiasm. But Breuer tweeted out that he believes he's got a mathematical path to winning this thing as well. Is that right?
Well, he got about 5% of the vote from in person on Tuesday from most of the counties. So mathematically, Daniel and I have just said how we don't know the winner yet, but I feel kind of comfortable saying that it probably won't be Mike Breuer. I think Daniel might agree with that.
So, Daniel.
Yeah, I mean, he's doing okay in, you know, what we're seeing in a lot of the rural counties, you know, and in-person voting. He certainly still got votes. And I think that he will, you know, absolutely play a factor in this race in terms of who wins between McGrath and Booker. But really, it would be a long, long, long shot for Breuer to win.
Daniel, what are the candidates doing at this moment, not necessarily in their personal lives at this exact moment, but what happens in the campaign world when the voting is over and then you're just waiting for them to be announced days later, something that we've not really experienced in Kentucky?
I think they're wringing their hands and pulling out their hair. it's kind of interesting because, you know, we have this week where in a normal election, you would be able to get this big fundraising boost out of Tuesday. And we have to wait a little bit for that. And so, you know, Mitch McConnell obviously is a big money guy and raises a lot of money. And so you're heading into the general election and he's got this week to raise money after winning his primary that wasn't really that much of a contest. And so then you're seeing McGrath and Booker acknowledge this and try to raise money, but they're doing it in different ways. So McGrath tried to do this, or is trying to do this thing where she puts it into a Senate Democratic fund where they'll put the money in there and whoever wins will get that money. Booker instead is still focusing on the idea of voter suppression and is still raising money. Now it's to get election observers and that sort of thing. So his path is, you know, his money's still going to his campaign, whereas McGrath saying, hey, let's put this in a pot and it should go to whoever wins so that McConnell doesn't get too much of an advantage out of this week.
And Joe McConnell is the undefeated, undisputed champion of this seat. What's he doing right now?
Well, his campaign just said that they've raised $1 million since Election Day. So they're already sprinting out of the gate while Booker and McGrath are still waiting at the starting line to see who's going to be eligible for the race. So he's already gotten a head start.
Joe Sonka from the Courier-Journal and Daniel DeRocher from the Lexington Herald-Leader. Thanks to both of you for taking the time and sharing this important perspective with us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Michael.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Despite off and on criticism and calls to change the mascot at Anderson High School, it remains the Redskins. That's a name many considered derogatory and racist towards Native Americans. So the Forest Hills Board of Education will meet next week to consider again a change. So let's get a preview on that. Joining us now on the phone is Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Madeline Mitchell. Madeline, thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure to have you. The Anderson Redskins, this is not the first time that this has come up in an official controversy that needs to be addressed by school officials. Can you give us a little bit of the history of this controversy?
Yeah, I'd love to. So the Inquirer has reported on this a few different times. I mean, this is a debate that comes up, you know, all the time. People are always talking about this, but there are three times in the past couple decades that it's really come to a head and there have been votes by the school board. So that happened in 1999, in 2003, and again in 2018. And each of those times, the school board had decided to keep the name. So this will be the fourth time then since 1999 that we're going to possibly come to a vote. They haven't officially said it'll come to a vote. There's going to be a meeting on Tuesday about the future of the Redskins name.
It seems that this is different in that it's coming in a moment where there's a lot of reflection taking place across the nation in a variety of ways, across a lot of different industries and sectors and cultural organizations about the way racial issues are discussed, the way people are treated or referred to. So who is behind the drive to change it this time? Is it any different than years past?
That's a great question. I think that it's maybe not necessarily one person. You know, there is a big push from younger people in the community. A lot of current students and recent graduates are behind the movement. And it looks like there was a recent graduate who started the petition. So that you can see on change.org. Right now I'm looking at it and they have a little over 2,700 signatures on that petition to change the school's mascot. And that's a lot of younger people, like I was saying. But then there's also on Facebook, there have been a lot of posts from adults, older adults in the community who have just had enough. I talked to one woman who lives in Anderson, and she sent her kids to school elsewhere because of this. And she said she'd never taken a stand before, but felt that, you know, with George Floyd, and there's, you know, this national outcry for change happening right now. So I think people are feeling more comfortable standing up for things that they maybe didn't feel comfortable standing up for before.
And to be clear, this meeting is not one where we'll see a lot of raucous dialogue. This is something that is going to be taking place digitally, correct?
Yeah, so this is scheduled to be on their YouTube page. I'm not sure exactly how they're planning to have members of the community speak. I don't know if they're getting called in or if there's going to be, you know, like some sort of a Zoom element to it. But I know that the public can watch the meeting through YouTube.
And you did get a statement from the superintendent. It doesn't seem to take a position on one way or the other as it relates to this nickname, this mascot that many people find offensive, but that they are going to be listening and looking for ways to, quote, empower every student every day.
Right. Yeah. The email, so it was sent out to family members and staff members at not just Anderson, but the Forest Hills School District. And yeah, I would agree. It doesn't really indicate any sort of happening. It says that there will be a dialogue. It says that they're going to make a point to have a discussion. And I know that a lot of people online, a lot of the activists, had been hoping for a vote on Monday, at Monday's school board meeting. And they are not going to be discussing anything about the mascot on Monday. And instead, they've kind of scheduled this whole other time to specifically dedicate to discussion about the Redskins mascot.
Madeline Mitchell is a reporter with the Cincinnati Inquirer. Madeline, thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Let's talk baseball. Joining us now on the phone is sports radio host Andy Furman. Andy, thank you for being back with us.
Michael, it's a pleasure. The pleasure's all yours, of course, but it's always great having time with you on Cincinnati Edition on WVXU.
I knew you were going to be extra excited today because you're going to have some baseball to watch this summer, it sounds like.
Well, you know what? I'm cautiously optimistic because here's my take on this. Yes, I'm excited. Yes, I want to see it go back and watch on TV, listen on the radio, wherever it may be. Number one, no fans will be permitted. No media is going to have a lot of access there. That's number two. But number three, here's my question. What if a teammate or teammates test positive? The other teammates are going to say, we're not playing anymore. And I think it's going to end. So my feeling is this. I want to see the season through, but I think in the bottom of my heart, there's a possibility that that season may not go the distance.
And that's got to be that's a nice Field of Dreams reference, right? Go the distance. That was one of the lines. Is it not?
You're exactly right. I can't fool you. I can't.
But you raise this point at an interesting time because we are seeing this case surge across the country in a variety of places. And how did that impact the conversations? Or was the union, the players' union and the owners, were they mostly focused on money? Or was COVID-19 a factor at all?
Michael, I learned something a long time ago. When you have a question and you don't know what the answer might be, trace it back to money. It's always about money. And I'll tell you why. If anyone in any sport, the NFL, the NHL, NBA, Major League Baseball, if they were truly concerned about health and safety, they wouldn't play at all. They wouldn't play at all. I mean, you see on a daily basis people coming positive. And I give you an example on the college front, LSU, Clemson, The other day, Kansas State had 14 players test positive. They're talking about playing football. They're talking about putting people in the stands. They're talking about the Kentucky Derby having fans. Who in their right mind is going to sit next to someone that you don't even know at a sporting event? I don't even want to go to the movies. I'm seeing commercials on TV now that films are opening in theaters near you on Friday. Who's going to go to the movies? I'm not going.
We saw that some players in the Twins organization have tested positive for COVID-19. So, I mean, your concerns are already being played out. And I think we just saw the state of Florida announced that it's shutting down its bars again. So, I mean, there are some reopening efforts that are being dialed back. And I mean, you're a sports radio host, and I think the last time you were on, it was already in the midst of this pandemic. I asked, what are you even talking about at this point? Because there's no active sports taking place. But I mean, how antsy is the country for sports? Are we willing to let, you know, our desire to watch competition outweigh our need to be safe?
Well, I think you have to weigh what is a human life worth as opposed to how much do we care about the economic and the economic factor of what sports brings to us. And look, there's a domino effect, obviously, in the world of sports, not only athletes, but front office people, media people, people that work the parking lots, the concessions. There's so many people that fall in line when sports is not active. So that's the problem right there. But there was an NFL player the other day who basically came out and said that the NFL, I'm quoting him now, we are not essential. He's the only smart guy I've ever heard of in the last several months. Yes, the NFL or any other sport is not essential, but it's essential to the wallet. It's essential to the bottom line. It's essential to the pocketbook. That's where it's essential. And TV money is at the brink of it. That's the pot of gold for Major League Baseball, and they don't want to lose that.
You mentioned that the Kentucky Derby will be held with fans in some capacity at Churchill Downs in Louisville, although we've already run the Belmont, and so the Triple Crown is out of order. The Derby was postponed for the first time in many decades. What did you think watching the Belmont in this strange situation in which it was run?
Well, you hit the nail on the head. It's very strange with no fans there, but still in all, I mean, they say, you know, it must go on. And again, I look at that term essential. Is it essential? Well, it's essential to the breeders. It's essential to the horse owners. It's essential to the trainers, to the people who put their work in every single day. It's essential to TV. I mean, they look at programming. And look, I don't want to sit at home and watch the Kentucky Derby from 1958. I don't want to see that. I want to see live sports, and people are doing that. People are going crazy, and that's forcing this. But I think that the fact that it's spiking in so many areas, and Ezekiel Elliott of the Dallas Cowboys about 2 weeks ago tested positive. I mean, to me, football is the lone sport that there is so much contact on every single play. How on earth can they even think of playing football? They canceled the Hall of Fame game in August in Canton, Ohio. And the other day, John Harbaugh, the coach of the Baltimore Ravens, said, look, we've been issued a whole set of rules from the National Football League. He says, I don't know how on earth we're going to have people 6 feet apart in the huddle. I don't understand it. How is it going to happen?
Now, I know in sports radio, it's a little different than maybe a public news talk show. Your fans who call in can be angry and you guys have a fun back and forth. And that's all exciting to listen to, of course. I'm wondering, though, if you would share with us, what are callers? What's the general public upset or anxious about? Or do they tend to see it your way after a good talking to?
Yeah, that's a great question. It really is. I think the general public right now is like, they think it's over. I think as soon as states have opened up, the mindset to many is that, well, the pandemic is over. And the fact that sports are coming back slowly but surely, the NBA, the end of July, baseball in about 3-4 weeks. So if their mindset is that it's over, and believe me, as soon as it starts, there's going to be noise and a lot of noise from callers on these shows that, well, if it's open and is it playing, why can't we go see it? That's going to be the next step. And if bars are open, why can't the ballparks be open? And that's going to happen. I know it.
30 seconds. If the season, the 60-game season is played through, what should we be looking for from the Reds?
Well, I think they'll be competitive. I honestly do. I think they spent a lot of money in the offseason. I think they got a pitching staff. But I think that in this 60-game season, it's going to be every game's going to count. It's going to be very exciting. Does it mean anything? I tell you what, if they go to the World Series and they win it all, yeah, it means something. It really does. But I think you've got to get up to a hot start, which they have not done in years past.
Andy Furman, a legend of local airwaves and airwaves beyond our area. Andy, thank you so much for your time.
Michael, have a great weekend. Stay safe.
You too. And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you so much for supporting us during our fun drive this week. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our technical director is Josh Elstrow. Our theme song is composed by Rob Fetters. You can find archives of this program and all the other ones online at WVXU.org. We're back on Monday. Have a great weekend. I'm Michael Monks.